your host, Michael Cohen, with the Capital City Recap on More Compelling Talk Radio, 1320 WILS.
We are back. I'm Michael Cohen. This is 1320 WILS. Thank you for joining us. Well, it's titled The 32 Innovations That Will Change Tomorrow, a piece in the New York Times that has caught fire being passed around and discussed on the internet. Maggie Kurth Baker, the author of Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us, wrote the intro to the list of futuristic items where she explains just how long the process of change can take. She joins us now. Maggie, thanks for coming on 1320 WILS.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in the intro, you point out that Thomas Edison invented the incandescent light bulb in 1879, but it wasn't until the 1920s that electricity really began to be used robustly by Americans. What makes this kind of an amazing innovation take 40 years to really explode?
Well, it was really interesting because what I found in my research came from my book, and what I found out was that we didn't know how to run a business that required a huge overhead and infrastructure development before you could even start making money in the 1800s. Like, nobody had experience with that kind of industry before. And so you had all these problems happening with electric utilities and also with long-distance train travel at the same time. Basically, any industry that had to build lots of infrastructure before it could get going had a really hard time making money, and companies failed over and over and over before they could really get taken off.
I see. So the 32 innovations, I can't say any of them appeared to be anything nearly as innovative as a new light bulb, but the cycle of their product, looks like within 2 years, a lot of those different ideas they had were going to, I guess, expand dramatically. Is the cycle now just so much faster because of our understanding of how quickly a good innovation can be spread?
I don't know if the cycle of big, huge changes like the light bulb is any faster, but it's a lot faster to bring like small changes in technology forward and get them actually out to the public and available for purchase.
The innovation list included, electric clothing, about 2 years away, far better tasting coffee, a few more years away now, adaptive cruise control. I thought that was pretty interesting. That avoids massive traffic congestion. Expected to be in
that was one of my favorites, too, actually.
Yeah, expected to be in 7 million cars by 2017. I guess, we share that in common. On the whole, though, it seemed like most of the innovations were fairly trivial. What did you think of them?
I thought that they were things that are trivial, but are not necessarily as trivial as you think they are. Particularly if you think about number 17, which was Terrifying Playgrounds, where they're talking about psychology researchers who look at what children actually need for development and to learn how to kind of take their knocks and figure out how to navigate the world around them. What they need are playgrounds that aren't as safe as we've made playgrounds. And that seems like a really trivial thing, but at the same time, it's really not, because it has a lot to do with, you know, how you're shaping the development of the next generation, and that could have huge impacts years from now.
It's interesting that this invention of an adaptive or innovation of an adaptive cruise control is going to be big when, you know, you wonder if part of the movement is going to be towards enhancing public transportation to avoid this massive traffic congestion problem we have.
Oh, I think there's definitely going to have to be a good chunk of that. The thing with the adaptive cruise control that I thought was really interesting was a few years ago I posted a thing at boingboing.net where I'm science editor that was talking about the theories behind why traffic jams happen. And there's this whole idea of shockwave effects where people follow each other too closely. And so when you tap on the brake, you get this little kind of like a ripple in the water spreading out backwards where everybody has to stop really quick. And that's how you get those kind of traffic jams where there's nothing apparently actually happened. And I really like the fact that adaptive cruise control thing was targeted at sort of solving that specific kind of problem.
And one thing's for sure, it's always one person's fault, someone way up in front there. I'm talking to Maggie Kurth Baker, the author of Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us. And in fact, Maggie, one area where we clearly need a lot of innovation is in energy. In your book, what do you see as the most promising area where we will be able to find some real answers?
I think we're really going to have to make some big changes to the way that our grid works. One of the things that I ran across in my research for the book was that energy isn't just sources and it's not just our personal choices. It's really about these systems that kind of shape how we use energy and what energy we can use. And so it's things like making sure our electric grid is actually something adapted so that people can have a solar panel on their roof and have it work with the infrastructure instead of working against the infrastructure. And it's also things like public transportation, like you mentioned. I mean, I live in Minneapolis, and I can get out my front door right now and get on the number 6 bus, go anywhere in the city I want to go. And because of that, my husband and I only have one car, and we get on just fine. But if you go down to Kansas City, where most of my family's from, they don't have infrastructure like that. So if you ask them to drive less, you're asking them to shoot themselves in the foot.
But tell me, how problematic is our electric grid right now? And if we're talking about physically restructuring the grid, wouldn't that require a massive investment?
It would require a massive investment, but it's also something, it's an investment that's going to happen anyway. What we are dealing with right now is an electric grid that really hasn't been updated in any kind of large-scale way since the 1970s. And I honestly can't think about any technology that I use every day that's running on 1970s technology besides the electric grid. And it's definitely going to be in need of changes, and the changes that we can do are things that can make it work better with renewable energy, that can enable us to use less energy and still get all the services we need and want. And I think that those are really good things to combine.
When you say the lights going out, is that a very real potential in your mind after the research you've done for the book that we could see a situation where big portions of the country could lose power and energy for a long period of time?
I don't think so. I think that that's more of a metaphorical phrase than anything else. There is definitely a very real potential with the way that our grid is currently structured that it's a lot easier for us to have blackouts right now than it would be if we made some of these upgrades. You know, one of the things that smart grids are really able to do is both prevent blackouts and make it a lot easier and faster to get people back online after a blackout happens. They had an experience with that in Vermont after the hurricane last year.
Now, when it comes to green energy, is there any portion of the technology that you see now that you think is likely going to be where we could get a lot of our energy from?
I think we're going to have to think about energy, where we're getting a lot of our energy from, in a different way. We're so used to having this one single source, fossil fuels, and we get all of our energy from fossil fuels, and that's it. That solves our problem. But I think as we go forward in time, we're going to find that it's a lot more complicated in the future. That for, the next foreseeable future, for my entire lifetime, we're going to get energy from fossil fuels, we're going to get it from solar power, from wind power, from hydroelectric power, and we're going to need all of those things working together. You can't really just drop off any of them. And I think that that's something we really kind of have to come to terms with.
Right, because, the truth is that our reliance on fossil fuels is enormous, and isn't it true that really any of these new energy sources really can provide only just a minute amount of the actual energy we need now and we will need as our population expands?
They are capable of providing the energy that we need. You would have to be using lots of different sources because not every place has the same natural resources. The problem is that they can't provide all the energy we need right now, partly because of the infrastructure, partly because we are going to be needing a lot more battery storage systems than we have today. And those are all expensive infrastructure development that are going to take a really long time to actually come to fruition. When you talk about short-term and infrastructure development, you're talking about 40 years. And, there's a lot we can do in the short term, but we can't get entirely off fossil fuels in the short term.
I see. And in terms of our fuel usage, obviously we're so reliant on gas right now. Did you discuss that in the book? And do you have any thoughts on the type of transition we'll be making away from gas, maybe to using natural gas potentially?
Yeah, I think that one of the things I try to discuss in the book is that we are really in a place where any decisions that you make, you have to deal with downsides. There's nothing that we can do that's going to eliminate all of the risks, that's going to eliminate all of the negative aspects of our choices right now. So we kind of have to start having some really good conversations as a public, as our politicians, about what risks we're willing to live with and which ones we aren't. And I think that that really comes into play when you're talking about things like natural gas, because there are obviously downsides to that, but at the same time, there are benefits to that. And I think it could make a good transitional fuel for us, but you have to deal with those downsides, and you have to think about those downsides, and you can't just pretend they don't exist.
And your views on nuclear energy, do you think the downsides there are overwhelming, and this kind of energy is not one we will be relying on in the long term. I mean, we certainly haven't been investing in it recently, so.
No, we've not been investing in it recently, but I have kind of, the way I've been describing my relationship with nuclear power is that we're frenemies. Clearly it has some problems. It has some big issues, particularly in the fact that we don't know what we're doing with the waste. But at the same time, it's also a lot cleaner than any other kind of electricity generation that we can do that's not, you know, wind and solar. So it's really a complicated question, and I don't think it's as easy as let's just get rid of nuclear power. But I don't know whether the political willpower or the cultural willpower is there anymore to think about nuclear power in a nuanced way.
I see. Do you think in general we're positioning ourselves step by step, year by year, in the direction we need to be to have energy in a sustained way right now?
And on some levels, yes. The thing that I worry about is that it's not happening as fast as it could. And what concerns me is, you know, what negatives we're going to have to deal with because we're not making these changes as fast as we could do that. What the scientists tell me is we've gotten to the point now when you're talking about the effects of climate change that we're not talking about preventing climate change. We're talking about limiting the impacts that happen. And I think about my children, I think about my future, and that's something that does concern me, as does the limited supplies of fossil fuels. You know, I had a guy from the natural gas industry that I heard speak who was talking about how we'll have plenty of natural gas. We don't need to worry about anything. We've got tons. We've got enough to last 200 years. And I just kept thinking, you know, you have a different definition of plenty than I do.
I see. Yeah. You're saying longer than a couple hundred years would be nice to rely on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I know if you're, you know, particularly when you're trying to get me to increase the amount of this fuel that I'm using, telling me that at current usage rates, we've got 200 years supply is not enough.
Well, certainly some innovations. Hopefully we'll see some of those along the way. Maggie Kurth Baker, author of the book Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us. You can find her online at maggiekb.com. Maggie, thank you very much for joining us on WILS this evening.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Now, when we come back, we're going to talk about worker productivity. It's been the focus of businesses for quite a long time now, but they still find there are a lot of things that reduce productivity. We'll focus on what they are and what can really be done to reduce these new factors, which include, of course, email. That is next. I'm Michael Cohen. You're listening to 1320 WILS.